The following program is a production of KHNS. Its content does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Board of Directors and staff of Lynn Cannell Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee.
And hello and a welcome to Talk Around Town. I'm Deborah Schnabel, your guide through today's talk about community matters. Here's the rundown. We'll start the biweekly news review with Chilkat Valley News editor, publisher, and sometimes pundit Tom Morfitt. We'll check in with the Southeast Alaska Skate Fair. And today's talking topic is jury duty. With us to talk about their personal experience in this most American civic duty are Heidi Robichaux, Steve Vick, and Glenda Gilbert. Hey, who are you? Introduces us to yet another community member. Also today, PM Forney's 19th rule of considerate conduct. Stay with us. And a good morning to you, Mr. Morfitt.
Good morning, Deborah.
You look bright and chipper today.
I'm a little bit, out. I woke up a little late.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've been on the show.
2 weeks.
Well, no.
Oh, no, that's
no,
right.
No, no. It was actually three weddings ago.
Three weddings ago.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a feeling this is leading into something.
Yeah.
What's up?
Well, I just wanted to give the wedding report. We're about midway through the wedding season. We've had Cohen Bishop, Hedrick Fink, Carter Webster, and Fossman and Lindsley this week. Fossman and Lindsley, and still to come this summer: Samansky Reitz, Nash Stickler, and Shields Hawken, by my count. So,
I think there's a Reed Schwabach in there also.
Oh,
right?
That's
of course,
right.
That marriage is taking place, but I think it's a ceremony. But for local accounts,
for local people,
yeah, it's
let me get
it's
that
a
one
wedding.
Down. Thank you. I knew there was a couple more floating.
Yeah, well, what a wonderful thing. I mean, it's hope. These kinds of things are always a testimony to the goodness of life and moving forward in progress. You know that?
Yeah.
Affirmations of the goodness of life.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me, we haven't had many winter weddings. We get a few of those, but, you know, winter is our kind of a dominant season. I like to say that because everybody, you know, it kind of shows up here in the summer, but our dominant season in terms of time is winter.
Right, but I mean, all the boots. Where would you put all the boots? You know, I mean, that's the problem, you know, with a winter wedding is all the clothes, you know. No one has a cunny chuck big enough, you know, to handle all the boots and parkas.
And getting everybody here on time.
Right, through
the weather.
So, right.
Okay. Well, my favorite story this week was the new tower on the Fort Seward Fire Hall.
Of course, it's certainly the most obvious, I think.
And just a great, it's my favorite Anglo totem since Dave Hammer's Bigger Hammer.
All right. And an Anglo totem. So, on the parade ground perimeter, we have
about a 60-foot tower. It's not an observation tower, unfortunately. Partly because once you go up that high and you put people in there, you need a very expensive sprinkler system.
Oh, is that the reason you're not going into the tower? Okay.
So it's a six, as co-owner Phyllis Sage says, it's six stories of cold tower. There's a name for that when you have a building that's
and it
up.
Used to be the hose tower. I mean,
it was
did function
historic,
as
right,
a hose tower.
Right, and apparently maybe because those early hoses were more prone to rot, you really had to dry those out.
Oh, uh-huh.
The later hoses maybe weren't as susceptible to damage once they got moldy.
Mm-hmm.
But a great example by doing from the private sector, mm-hmm. you know.
And you have been grants. Promoting that a little bit here recently, that a lot is being done in the private sector, perhaps as a call to action by downtown revitalization.
Yeah.
And people are like waking up and saying, well, you know, I could do this. I could do that.
Well, it's infectious, I think. You know, somebody does a little something, the guy across the street goes, I'm going to do this. And so really great to see. And the other thing I wanted to note about the tower in the fort was that from design and engineering and construction, all local talent. Mm-hmm. No PND, no, you know, Rasmussen Foundation. It was all local people putting their heads together. So very impressive. Nobody got hurt and they went six stories up. They're dangling, you know, equipment up on a boom.
There certainly was technology involved.
Yeah, a lot of brain power
right,
there.
Right, right. Yeah, well, excellent. So, good example.
Thing to see.
Good.
We're back towards July, and again, we're scrambling over fireworks. We do this every year. This is actually a topic for the whole Lynn Canal, because Skagway looks like they've just about written off having a show. And we, as of this week's paper, looking pretty iffy whether we can pull together a fireworks show for the 4th of July. Has to do with getting a qualified pyrotechnician. There's only a few of them. There's a small number of these guys licensed to do this in the state. And Philip Wild, our guy, has cited just a bunch of headaches with him and with the job, you know, doing this. And he's kind of had it.
Retired, right.
Yeah, he told us that a year ago.
And we didn't believe him or what? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the topic's dead.
Yeah, well,
you know, I don't care. It's never really made sense to me to have fireworks, you know, in Alaska in a northern climate anyway. As you've always said, save them for
New Year's
Eve.
New Year's,
that would be a good thing.
So, but we'll see, because there's typically a big rush. We got to have, you know, even on my own staff, there is a fireworks constituency that says we have to have fireworks. You know, it's like having hot dogs on the 4th of July, but we'll see.
Okay.
This week, three-month evaluation of David Sosa, our new manager in Haines. No public statements that I'm aware of from the assembly on that.
Well, I think that Margaret Friedenauer did call for a statement from the mayor.
Yeah. Well, that would be
Margaret,
nice.
Would you like to tell us what did the mayor say? Would you report what the mayor said?
I believe she just said it was unanimously overwhelming support and hoping he has a long tenure after they came out of executive session.
Yeah. Margaret Friedenauer, KHNS News Director, helping us here. And I do want to comment that I think that the story that that KHNS ran recapping the history, the professional history of Joel, is certainly of news, and there's kind of a follow up that the story has gone statewide. I think that's interesting to just recap that.
And that's Jason Joel, former police sergeant, resigned under unknown circumstances
in several places.
In several places, not believed to be flattering circumstances, I'd say. And I think it gets to and this thing with Sosa, I think gets to our inability to discuss personnel on a public level. When we run for the cover of executive session, we say, "Oh, geez, these are subjects that tend to prejudice the reputation of a person, so we can do this legally under the allowances for executive session." However, if an evaluation is 95% positive, and you know. I question whether you actually qualify for
ruining somebody's
ruining someone's reputation. Right. I just went to such an extreme at the school, at the Haynesboro School District. We would ask for the written evaluation of Mr. Beyer, who did, by all accounts, an exemplary job as superintendent. Used to get like straight A's, except for one might be A minus for parting his hair on the wrong side or something. I can't remember. It was so silly. And we would ask for the written evaluation, and the district became so
protective
of that they did away with written evaluations, had the whole evaluation verbal, So that when they came out of executive session, they wouldn't actually have to give us anything. Mm-hmm. Finally, I think we have cajoled them to write a statement in which they say, he's a great guy. Mm-hmm. So I do think...
Which is kind of what the mayor did.
Yeah. Which, you know, I think the public, I mean, as a public advocate, I think the public deserves something a little meatier than that.
Right. And I think that KHNS, you know, recognized that. I mean, this Jason Joel, who's had a checkered past, I guess, all professionally all the way through, is now seen apparently as a security officer serving the state of Alaska on Alaska Marine Highway.
Right.
Just confirm that, yeah. Margaret. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you raised the question of how did that happen? And maybe you're right, Tom, that it's just too much protection of people's, you know, the individual has a lot of protection in the United States of America, mm-hmm. you know, and the individual is foremost, you know.
Well, I wish it were that. I think it's to a certain extent, I think what happens is public officials freeze up instead of thinking what words to choose to explain what – how a person may be deficient in the job. Mm. I mean, I can tell you right now 5 ways that I'm deficient in my job.
Thank you.
And,
you
and Margaret can tell you 10.
You don't belong to I mean, that's the problem, though. You don't belong to a union that would then come back and advocate for your right. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not saying unions are the problem. I'm saying that there is a lot of protection when you're dealing with union employees at a state or local level, because then the borough or the state wants to be able to protect themselves from lawsuits that in some cases they, you know, the individual or the union says they have the right to bring. So, yeah, it's mm-hmm.
That's a convoluted. Too bad. So anyway, the Jason Joel story is an example of how somebody can maneuver through the system and yeah. be rewarded even when it's probably not warranted.
Rewarded
with a job.
Well, and then just a dearth of real information. Last mm-hmm. year, we caught some flack. We used some anonymous sources to get real information out on the former police chief. I dare say that the lack of information allows problems to be passed on from one municipality to the other. And we recently almost saw this at school level, where we had a superintendent candidate who had left under, mm-hmm. you know, questionable circumstances. Right. When he applied here, we had no knowledge of it. Google has got to the bottom of this better than the rest of us have. Okay.
Yeah, we got to wrap up fast here. We've got some other notes.
Well, the one of our biggest events of the year coming up before in the next show is the bike race. I don't know what year we're on, 2023, 24.
That's not this coming weekend. It's the following, correct?
Yeah. Next weekend.
Next 21st.
And I think we have the KHNS fundraiser before the next show as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom.
A lot of talking will be going on.
All right. Yeah. A lot of talking going on. Thank you.
Thanks.
Ubiquitous booklet made of newsprint listing the events, the entry categories, the entertainment for the 46th annual Southeast Alaska State Fair is out. Right?
Here it is.
Right? And today we're checking in with Executive Director Jessica Edwards to help us plan ahead for this great annual event. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you, Deborah.
I can imagine that getting the fair booklet out on the streets is a benchmark of some sorts for you and your staff. What does it signal for you?
You know, it just signals the first moment that the community can really start to participate in an active way in the fair for that year.
Mm-hmm.
And it also signals to us a lot of work that we've accomplished and thinking that we've had to already do about this year's event. So it mm-hmm. is fun. It is mm-hmm. fun to have it out.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything wildly different planned for or expected this year? I glanced through the booklet and seems like it's pretty much the same perfect agenda.
It is. You know, the exhibit guide, we do little tweaks to it every year mm-hmm, in terms of mm-hmm. what's We're working on some changes to preserve foods. We're always sort of tweaking the, mm-hmm. the entry categories just mm-hmm. a little bit and the rules mm-hmm. and regulations. Mm-hmm. But pretty much the same categories
okay.
and such.
Okay. And entertainment. Let's talk about that.
We do have some entertainment.
Yeah, I saw that. It's interesting. I saw it from Kansas, Louisiana, and from Tennessee. So we're kind of like Midwest to South. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that seems to be increasingly kind of more where we pull from. Is that just a trend?
It's not a coincidence.
Okay, what is that about?
So our entertainment coordinator, Beth Bolander, has spent one of her personal recreation activities is to visit festivals mm-hmm. and see music. Mm-hmm. And she has made a trip or two every year now into the Midwest to do different festivals. Oh. The Winfield Walnut Valley Festival in Kansas is one of them. And it's a big bluegrass festival. And so she's connected with musicians there that she's got excited about the fair. Mm-hmm. And there are people that she's been able to see live and knows that they'll be a great connection for our audiences here.
So has she seen Split Lip Rayfield?
Yes.
Does he have a split lip?
No.
Oh.
No.
I thought, wow, that would be interesting.
I actually don't know where the name comes from. But she has been working on this group to come for the last 3 years. She's mm-hmm. been at the Walnut Valley Festival, and she said, please come. And finally it worked out that they could this year.
All right. And we have the Vagabonds Swing
Yes,
group?
They're from Louisiana. They're heavy on the brass and the horns.
Oh, I love that.
Yes,
part.
It's going to be really fun.
And the Elephant Revival and Harrison B.
So the Elephant Revival is a band that we're getting a lot of buzz about as well. They are coming from Nederland, Colorado, mm-hmm. and they have this kind of old-timey, I can't call it bluegrass, but it's got this really beautiful melodic, lots of singing, lots of harmonizing. Mm-hmm. It's very upbeat, though. And they're also going to play this year at Salmon Stock, which is a festival in Nanalchik. So they're going to be here for a stop and then on mm-hmm. to sort of an Alaskan tour.
Okay,
and
cool.
People are very excited about seeing them.
I was interested in the Skagway Aerial Company. Is there an aerial company in Skagway?
Would you believe it? There's an excellent aerial company in
really?
Skagway.
Really? Interesting. Yes. I'm so excited about that.
Beth,
where
in
do
all
they
of
perform
travels?
In Skagway?
They
don't?
They do.
They do.
Uh-huh. Wherever the reception for the Buckwheat Ski Classic was held, mm-hmm. that's where Beth mm-hmm. saw them and met mm-hmm. them and was floored.
Very cool.
Yes.
All right. So trapeze artists and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay.
I think silks.
Okay. Now, you have a big, long list of things, and I didn't want to, preclude whatever it is that you'd like us to know.
I just brought a lot of notes because
oh, okay.
I figured I could be prepared for any place our conversation
okay.
took us.
Well, great, because one of the things that I want to talk about today was unleashing your inner fair. That's
our theme
this year. And I look at the booklet and I think of how much of it is unleashing your inner Forster is what I was thinking. The board members, talking about the board members.
Oh, I see.
And their contributions. And I was looking at, we don't often talk about the board members and what they bring to the fair. Certainly with the Forster, there's the art that's brought
right.
forward
in
the cover,
yes.
is pretty attractive and interesting, kind of takes you somewhere,
yes.
That we haven't really been before.
Always.
Yeah. And so I thought we should just, for their sake and for ours, it's Kevin Forster, Paul Wheeler, Deborah Marshall, Teresa Raven, and just a minute, who else is on there?
Courtney Kolbeck.
Courtney.
Roger Tungy.
And
Josh Benassi.
Yeah.
And it's actually Eric Forster.
Eric.
Kevin
okay.
Was on the board as well, but had some reasons for
sure.
for moving on last year. But he's still actively, he's on the fairgrounds regularly helping
mm-hmm.
out. So
mm-hmm.
We have a great board. They
yeah,
are so
good.
Energetic and they participate in so many ways.
Right, because there's a lot more to the fair than just those 4 days. There are
right.
other things that go on. And I do want to talk for a minute about the event that's coming up here on the 21st, I guess it is. I can't turn my head around. And that's you're hosting the Fisherman's Feast,
right.
I guess.
The King Salmon Barbecue mm-hmm. with the Lincanow
right.
Gillnetters.
Right.
And that's an excellent – we work with them. They want to do a seafood promotion event.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Haynes's version, and it's really a great opportunity for people to come out and have some king salmon,
One of the things that was asked of me to ask of you was mm-hmm. the scheduling of that event during the solstice and Chilkat bike relay. And the I don't know, is it a problem or is it an opportunity? Is it a challenge? I mean, what is it when you have 1,400 other people, there's 2,800 other people in town, and you're basically giving food away?
Yes.
Yes, talk about that.
So I think it's all of the things. It is. But I think we primarily see it as an opportunity to get Wild Alaska seafood in front of a broad audience. Mm-hmm. And that's really the goal, to get people excited about eating it and wanting to recommend it to their families and to their uh-huh. friends and to mm-hmm. say, this is really the mm-hmm. best of the best. Mm-hmm. And we get visitors and residents mm-hmm. probably in mm-hmm. equal numbers.
But it's not
event.
A part of the bike race
no.
festivities necessarily.
Not
but
at
I'm
this
sure
time.
That people do get
right.
called over to there.
And we put a flyer in the bike race bag and we invite
oh,
folks
okay.
for sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. How many weeks to the fair, Jessica?
I'm not counting.
Okay, what are the dates again?
July 31st is the first day of the
fair.
Oh,
okay, July 31st.
And it runs through August 3rd. And so the thing to remember, though, is that the week before is the time to get your exhibits in.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons it's important to have you out and about at this time mm-hmm. of year, because it really does sneak up a whole
it
lot
does.
Faster. Really, that would be July 31st, so we really only have 5 to 6 weeks before
yes.
the fair. So if you are thinking that you'd like to enter something in the fair, it's, you know, you've got to start thinking about it today.
Now is the
right?
time. Yes.
Right. Okay. And get the fair book. They're all over town, right?
Correct. Yes. Okay. They're in most public and lots of stores, more locations and stores
okay.
as well. So the dates are Friday, July 25th and Saturday, July 26th are the drop-off days for exhibits locally.
All exhibits.
Except for perishables,
okay.
which come the day before the fair, that Wednesday before the fair.
Okay.
So we do all the baked goods and flowers and plants and stuff. That would be the 30th.
Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to encourage everybody, you know, who's been thinking about it to do it. It's
Please.
Always fun. You bet. It's always fun for everybody to go to the fair and see your stuff. All right.
Indeed.
Thanks a lot for coming in, Jessica.
Thanks, Deborah.
Yep. Be mindful of others. PM Forney, the author of Choosing Civility and co-founder of the Johns Hopkins Civility Project, has granted us permission to present selections from his book published by St. Martin's Press, New York. We've been exploring the rules of civility, or considerate conduct, or basically how to treat each other. And today we introduce rule number 19, care for your guests. This is an especially timely rule to discuss because Alaskans host guests all summer long, and it comes with the territory of just living here. So it's important to maintain civility and to exercise discretion and celebrate yourself and your guests to ensure that parting is not simply relief. So to entertain a guest is to make yourself responsible for his happiness. Guests shouldn't be made to feel that they must earn your hospitality. So you have to commit yourself to their well-being. Rules change for house guests that are staying a week or more. In these cases, you want a guest to feel at home, and that means liberating your guests by letting them take care of themselves. Let them help you with chores. That dispels their sense that they're imposing on you. And Mr. Forney says also, do not overwhelm them with attention, but let them know that you're happy to spend time with them, not all of your time, but much of your time. So do things that you would do even if they weren't with you. Planned activities are for your benefit also. Guests should feel that although they are in your home, they are still in charge of their own time. So don't overschedule. Claim time for yourself. Communicate your needs. Discuss your schedule. Make sure that your guests know how to reach you in an emergency. Hosting is a strengthening of mutual bonds. Listen and talk from the heart. Care for your guests. In 2008, the Haines District Court was remodeled to allow for superior court trials. A district court decides misdemeanor charges requiring a jury of six. Superior court tries felony charges requiring a jury of 12. This could mean that your chances of being called for jury duty are increased, and certainly the possibility of your serving on a jury trying a felonious charge went from no to yes. From the Alaska Jury Handbook, Alaska Trial Jury Handbook, quote, "Jurors play an essential role in the trial of civil and criminal cases. Although many people do not know what to expect from jury service, most look back upon it as a rewarding experience. Jury service is a tangible, challenging, and indispensable contribution to our country." Today, we're talking with three citizens who served jury duty on a superior court in Haines: Heidi Robichaux, Steve Vick, and Glenda Gilbert. Welcome to all three of you.
Thanks, Deborah.
Yeah, and thanks very much for coming in today. I want to explore the court system's characterization of jury service as challenging and rewarding. And I want to know your experience and whether you came away from the experience with any deeper appreciation for our legal system. So let's start with the beginning. Potential jurists in Alaska are selected at random from the pool of recipients of the Alaska Permanent Dividend. Did you know that? I always thought it was the voter record, but it's not. It's from the Alaska Permanent Dividend, because more people receive the Alaska Permanent Dividend than they do vote. So
doesn't
I thought that was pretty
tell
interesting.
Us a lot.
It tells us an awful lot. I know, human nature. So, first of all, how did you react to the notice of your selection? Glenda, let's start with you. You received that docket, that thing in the mail, said, you're on jury duty.
I usually don't get chosen, so it's just sitting there through the first panel and leave, or don't even get chosen then.
Mm-hmm. But when you got the notice in the mail, you know, did you say, oh, great, or did you say, I mean, what was your personal reaction to it?
I think most of us say, oh, no, okay, reschedule.
How about you?
Yeah, mine was panic because it just so happened that my daughter was visiting that week, and I was like, oh, no, it can't be, not now. And it turned out it was postponed.
Oh.
For a week, so I was just let off the hook.
And Steve?
Mine was very similar. It's just like, I'm not busy enough already. Now I have to go into for this.
Mm-hmm. But you all had a sense that you had to do it. I mean, because you know that is the law. When you're summoned, you're summoned, and you cannot ignore that, or you're, I guess, you could be arrested for not showing up, I think. So did you try to get out of jury duty? Any one of you?
No.
Okay. It is, I Googled this. There are all kinds of websites to tell you how to get out of, you know, how to kind of get out of jury duty, which is, you know, antithesis of what it's supposed to all be about. So it's interesting, you know, before you got called in, I think all of us as citizens, I think it starts when we're little kids, right? You kind of get told that this is one of the things about being in a democracy, being a member of the republic, that is not only a right, but a responsibility. So the jury trial handbook, trial by jury, being judged by our fellow citizens, is at the very heart of American justice. For the American citizen, there is no finer contribution to our democratic society than serving as a juror. That's out of the juror handbook. So I think that we kind of embrace that, all of us do. And so when we get the sense that, or when we get called, our sense is that we have to do it. It's not, you know, to try to run out. So the other thing I just wanted to, for background information, jurors, the requirements, I guess, are the qualifications. You have to be a citizen. You have to be a resident. 18 years or older, you have to be not only of sound mind, but also you have to be in possession of your natural faculties, which seem to me to be sort of the same thing. But you have to be able to speak or read English, and you cannot be on parole or probation from a felony charge. Those are the only things basically most all adults would fit into that. Blindness and deafness, incidentally, are not a reason to not serve on a jury. So let's just start. I want to know, just looking at it from an educational perspective, like you were involved in a process that is the United States legal system. Did you What did you find educational? Like, we're not talking about your emotional response to any of this, but were you educated to anything about the system through this whole experience? Steve, do you want to start?
Will you start? I will start. Sure, we're all looking at each other. I can appreciate the process and how the process works, and not only selecting the jurors, but the instructions that you're given when you actually go into the deliberation. Mm-hmm. It's very specific, and they hand you a thick packet when you go in there of probably 40 pages of instructions that are kind of state court system instructions, others dealing with the charges and definitions. And they pretty much put you in the back of a room right immediately after the trial was done. This is what kind of surprised me. We go into the jury room, they shut the door, they collect our cell phones, and you're done. You can't leave. Unless you have to go to the bathroom, of course. But it was immediate, like, go in here and start deliberating. And it felt not really rushed, but not quite as prepped or as prepared as I'd want to be just going right in there and going into it, because we kind of sat in there going, now what do we do? But we figured it out. I mean, there was the 40 pages of instructions, but it was really a quick – I guess I didn't feel I had enough preparation ahead of time, knowing that as soon as it was done and the closing arguments were made, that we were going to go back in this room and the doors would be closed. And if you need someone to be called, write down their number. Mm-hmm. And someone else will call them for you to take care of whatever business you have that afternoon.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Heidi?
Well, I just commenting on that, what struck me as well as what Steve was just saying is the fact that we didn't automatically get background information about the case. We had the basic description of what the case was. But, a lot of us were like, gosh, We want to know a lot more before we have to make this decision, but we're only to consider the evidence that as it was presented. And that was a very small part of the picture, as it turned out, for all of us to, mm-hmm. In our overall deliberations. But, we had this packet that said very specifically what we were to do if we wanted more information about anything. And we may or may not get that information. And so... for me, that was what really struck me. Is like, wow, I don't have enough information to deliberations.
Yeah. So one of the things that struck me in listening to you say that is, did you find yourself then thinking that the judging the presentations made by the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney, in other words, why did you not have the information and? And apparently you couldn't get it, right? Because you can only use what is presented. And even though you have questions, you can't ask them, right? Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yes.
Okay. Right. So that left you kind of hanging? That's a question. I mean, is that what a hung jury is, when they feel that they don't have enough information to have made a decision?
Hung jury is when we can't decide on the same verdict.
But is that a good enough reason to not be able to decide?
For some people it might be. There might not be enough information for them to determine whether the person is guilty or not. And for us, there was gaps in the information that we had to talk through as a group and try not to kind of fill in the gaps with our own guessing or mm-hmm. however we would figure mm-hmm. out what might have been going on, and really limit it to what was presented and determine whether that was enough to prove the guilt or innocence of the person. But every so often we get stuck on the gaps, like, well, this part's missing and we don't quite understand that, and we'd have to work through that and then set it aside going, we're not going to know that, we can't know that, mm-hmm. do we have enough?
Oh, great.
And that's the reasonable doubt part.
And did you get the question of law versus the question of facts? Did you get a presentation from the judge delineating what kinds of things you were supposed to be dealing with and what kinds of things the judge could deal with? I read that in the packet, that the question of law is debated by or is, I guess, commented on or handled by the legal system itself, but questions of fact are your purview.
That was for us to determine and interpret based on the attorney's presentations.
Mm-hmm. So, Glenda, what was your educationally, what did you learn from about the judicial system or about the process of judging your fellow man.
Well, I think it's the hardest thing you have to do on earth. And to it was nice that we were able to take notes. It was excellent that we were able to go back and ask the court to replay the tape of the testimony so that all of us could listen to it again, even though with 12 people taking notes, it was really helpful. I guess it was just a great learning process because it wasn't just one day. It was a whole week. Mm-hmm. And you got a little bonding with, I would consider, coworkers.
And that's the next thing I want to move to. Now, here you are, 12 people that have come together, just randomly selected in the community. These are people that you've probably seen, some of you, all your life. You see them at the post office. You see them at the grocery store. You see them everywhere. And now you're thrown into a room with them. And tell me what that experience was like. Did it open you up more to people? Like, did you find yourself being more open or shutting down or just more intrigued by some of the citizens of the community, things you didn't know? Did you learn a lot about other people, learn a lot about yourself?
Yeah. For me, I thought it was really interesting just to watch everyone kind of open up and respect other people's opinions. It was a really interesting – there was people when we went into the deliberation that had made up their mind already and others who really needed a lot of time and had a lot of questions. And I thought the respect and patience that other people showed for each other in a room full of strangers, mm-hmm. To allow people the space to come to their own kind of a determination on what the verdict would be for themselves.
So it wasn't 12 angry men.
No, okay. No, it wasn't. It was nice. And I thought that was really part of it was giving everyone an opportunity to speak freely and ask questions. And I thought people did really well of not interrupting and allowing people to have that space.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to make any comment?
Well,
go ahead.
I mean, if you're finished, because yeah. My comment would be different. But yeah, it's certainly the same as Steve's also. But one thing that struck me personally was, having gone through the jury selection process, where in this particular case, people were scrambling like rats on a sinking ship to get out of this jury duty. Mm-hmm. and so when I walked into the jury room with, you know, when it was settled down to the 12 of us, I looked around and I said, these are 12 people that are saying that, yeah, I may not want to deal with this, but I can handle this in an unbiased way.
Yeah. And part of, if I can just chime in real quick, part of not wanting to deal with it wasn't the fact that it was jury duty, it was the topic. And I think that's what made people scramble a bit.
Yeah, it was the nature of the crime. And so I went into that, the 12 of us, thinking that we had something in common to begin with. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
That we had made it through this exceptionally difficult jury selection process because of the nature of the case. And so that really struck me. And I almost went in feeling like that left me with an optimistic feeling that we could work together as a jury, even though it was very apparent from the start that we were from a really broad, you know, mm-hmm. aspects of Haynes and, mm-hmm. and political and, mm-hmm. you know, all sorts of different views mm-hmm. in life, mm-hmm. Very different. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And thanks for saying that, Heidi. I want to make sure that we're not talking about any particular case. You know, we're just talking about the experience of jury duty. And I'm sure that for every case, it would be the same, which, again, would bring me to a question of how you think that your you know, your life experience, you know, and how that is brought in and filtered. In a way, this jury selection process seems like the legal system, the attorneys, the judge, they are all, that's the time at which they make a determination about whether your experience, your value system, I mean, to the extent that you're willing to share it or expose it, they're judging you. So that's really interesting. Did you have the same sense, Glenda, when you went into the jury, when you found out who the 12 people were, did you sit around and say, I never would have invited these 11 people to dinner, right?
I was probably unique in the fact that I knew everybody in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect them from day one all the way through. I felt like, and I told everybody at the table, I said, everybody, I mean, the person sitting as a defendant should be proud that they have this group of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you know, the criteria that the attorneys and the judge used to choose us, but it was an excellent group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Broad spectrum and just different age groups and just everything.
So now walking around town, having served with 12 people on a jury, do you have you now have a relationship with these another person that you didn't have before?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But so tell me about also the experience of being the juror. Now, I don't know how long the trial went on. Sometimes trials are just a day. Sometimes they're an hour. I don't know. You know, but your experience went through the days and I think went over a weekend, right? So tell me about not talking about the trial. I mean, did you sequester yourself? Did you make sure that you went home and went on a long hike all day long so you wouldn't get caught into talking about the details of the case? And like for you that have a public persona, I suppose, you know, Glenda, you are in front of the public all day long at your store. So what is that like? Do you find that people in the community are wanting to engage and it's hard not to?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, being in jury duty for a week, I was behind the eight ball at work, so I was able to go upstairs in the office and pretty much work the weekend upstairs. And, you know, but I did have to wait the counter, and I did have to perform my normal duties and really not talk about the case and just say that, yes, I was still in jury duty and that I couldn't really talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you choose where you go and what you do over the weekend. Mm-hmm. There was certain places that I chose not to go or do because of the situation.
Did you find that, Heidi, for yourself also? That you felt like you had to kind of work at sequestering yourself?
No, not really. I mean, I'm kind of trained for not talking about stuff professionally, but I just naturally sort of wanted to withdraw for the weekend because I felt like we all had a lot of weight. I certainly felt like I had a lot of weight of being the judge.
You know, it's really interesting.
Being the judge so antithetical. What's the word?
Antithetical.
Antithetical. Whatever. It's so against what I want to be as a human being, you know, not only professionally, but individually. I don't want to judge my fellow man. And yet here was, this is what we had been tasked with doing in a very specific way. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And that was something that I thought during our deliberation, we spent not a lot of time, but a significant amount of time talking about what it meant to and how uncomfortable many of us were being the judge and kind of talked to each other kind of through that in some sense of, well, our job is we're not really judging the person. We are determining whether the actions committed a crime. And I thought that there was a few people in there who really expressed their uncomfort with that, their discomfort with that. And the support from others was just everyone felt that. And it was we had to process that.
Yeah. So what human qualities do you think contribute most to the process of judging a fellow human being? And I know that's
you mean in this context of the law,
well,
or do you mean
when
in
you're
general?
One of the things I think is really interesting is that we're all, maybe not you, Heidi, but many of us are prone to gossip. Many of us, you know, we just offhandedly make comments about people. We judge other people's behavior. We read the newspaper. We fold it up and say, well, you know, that I know what's going on there, you know, that sort of thing. But when you're really, really called to be a judge in a legal system where there are going to be consequences for that person that you're judging, is it a matter of, I mean, how much a whole bunch of things. I mean, the whole gamut of human experience comes in. Intelligence, common sense, compassion, discipline, all like Steve was saying, you know, you have to kind of keep pulling yourself back sometimes from what you might feel intuitively that you want to do.
Well,
you know,
as a piece of that, one thing that was difficult for all of us, I know, because we discussed it a lot, was that we were not allowed. We did not know what the consequences would be. And we were not supposed to research or look that up in our time off. And so all these other traits that you're talking about that go into, you know, this process of judging, we weren't allowed to consider the consequences, which was really,
really
challenging.
Were. I would think so. So, and would that have made a difference?
This guy could.
I guess it did because you talked about it, right?
I mean, we could have been talking about execution as a consequence, and we would not be allowed to consider that.
Okay. And were there other people in the room? I mean, juries, there are juries that are made up of people who are policemen or judges, I mean, retired perhaps, that sort of thing. I mean, it's not, you know, we're talking about, juries in general. Sometimes they have more depth of knowledge of the law, or maybe there's even people who have been through the process as a convicted felon. I don't know. I mean, Margaret's telling me, no, that's not so. I know you can't be on parole. You can't be on, but okay, you can't have been convicted of a felony. But I want to come back to you, Glenda, because you said it was the hardest thing. Did you say it was the hardest thing that you've ever done? Is that what you said?
It's a whole new job. It's a job where you listen to essentially a lecture, you take notes, and then you have to digest all that and go out into the jury room and share what your thoughts are. And it's like a whole another job that works with a different part of the brain that I don't normally use.
Are we talking about the problems of separating personal values from the I guess what you're charged to do in the justice system? That's one of the things that I think about is compassion, and you know sometimes you know people can be lenient, and I'll just introduce this for you, maybe give you some context. As a political person, and Steve, you've been on the assemblies. That's what I'd like to talk about. Sometimes you sit as an assembly member, a member of a body that has to make a decision, but somehow the clarity isn't always there for you when you're making decisions. Did you find that your experience as a juror to be in any way like the experience of assembly, or how is it different?
Well, for me personally, it was a lot like being on the assembly.
Oh, okay.
You're trying to follow a process, and there is a code that you're following. But it doesn't mean you can't. It's impossible to disregard your own empathy and compassion, which I think a lot of people had a hard time separating. We'd bring it in, and we could see that there was definitely a different life circumstance that the person's coming from, and people had empathy for that. And trying to not consider that as part of the case, as part of the actions of the crime, was very hard for people, because you could see how this could happen if you were raised in a situation as possibly this person was, and that was just the nature of being a victim in some sense. So we discussed that for some part. I think that separating out that compassion, it's hard. We're human, so we're going to have a lot of compassion. And you were talking earlier about there's a consequence, and we are the judge, and there's going to be a consequence if we decided the person was guilty and there would be a punishment. And trying not to let that punishment or potential punishment affect your decision, because who wants to be the one who causes someone a life-changing moment like this? Like, we're going to – our decision affected this person's life. But it was our responsibility to come up with the verdict on whether the actions committed a crime. But we're not responsible for the person's actions. And it's not our decision to make what the consequences will be. So in other words, we had to separate our ability, our compassion from, I'm not making this clear, but
well,
it was
I
hard
hear
to,
what you're saying,
yeah.
Steve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was difficult to do because in a sense you want to be compassionate, but it's not our fault the person's there. And we have to, and the actions weren't correct, and we had to determine whether the actions were right or not.
But, and here's, I think, where the big but is, we collectively are responsible for the law. So that brings me to my next question. Did you find yourself, and we, I don't want to speak about the content here or anything, but I could imagine that in many cases and that you would think, oh my goodness, this law might be a little bit like off or you know, I don't want to use this as the standard. And did it ever occur to you that, you know, maybe the law should be changed? I mean, murdering somebody is one thing, but I don't know.
One thing that struck me about that is that I was aware years ago I did some work in a Native community with Circle Peacemaking and dealing with justice issues in a more traditional way through communities coming together in a circle and just basically dealing with the victim and the families and the perpetrators and all that together, just dealing with it. Almost like family therapy, community therapy kind of a thing in a big circle. And I was acutely aware that we were not necessarily – well, we were clearly not a jury of this person's peers. And that struck me profoundly, and that sense grew as we were going through the process, although I felt we were an incredibly fair and compassionate jury, by the way. But – our system of 12 people randomly selected is a system that's developed in the Western world and is not part of, you know, a lot of traditional practices. So, you know, there are different ways of bringing on justice or bringing in justice and how can justice be part of the healing process. So that was something that I think we all struggled with, was how are we contributing? Yes, here we are contributing to justice. Here's the here's the verdict, and then the judge is going to do the sentence. But I think a lot of us, and I know personally I was struggling with, how are we contributing to the healing of, you know, our sick society, you know, our wounded systems that have contributed to, you know, this defendant's circumstances.
I think in some sense, I think the verdict will make probably the community safer in some sense, but the system isn't going to help the person who was found guilty come around in any way.
So in closing today, and I want to thank you very much for participating in this, but did you, I'd like to hear from each of you about coming away from the experience. How did it impact your sense of our system as being, I mean, do you have a greater appreciation for how our legal system works, or do you see yourself saying, you know, maybe there's a better way? Glenda?
Oh, I really respect that system. I think it's not a broken system. I think there's, I felt good. I felt like it was community service in a different way that we're not normally used to. I've even been thanked by some community members, so that was pretty neat.
All right, very good. Heidi?
Yeah, I felt that within the context of this system, I thought we did that this jury process was, to me, because there was 12 of us sort of randomly selected, we brought in a real broad, almost universal knowledge and response to this situation, and I feel like I gained an enormous respect for that body of 12, you know, the what, not only this specific body of us 12 jurors that we happen to be in this town in Haines, but 12 jurors, there's a lot of experience in amongst 12 people randomly selected. So I have a lot of respect for that.
Right. Well, and I just want to repeat this before I turn to you, Steve, for your final comment. Trial by jury, direct from the handbook. Being judged by our fellow citizens is at the very heart of American justice. And for the American citizen, there's no finer contribution to our democratic society than serving as a juror. Steve, want to respond to that and close us out?
I guess I'll kind of respond to what you were saying before and mm-hmm. like what we learned about it, or if it was the system works and mm-hmm. stuff and how it is for the jurors. I think it, in some sense, it's a necessary sacrifice for the jurors. It's your civic duty to do this. You are sacrificing your time and your, and there's an emotional investment in there. And I think at the end of the trial, I remember walking out, I kind of jokingly said, as the verdict was read and we were free to go, I was like, anyone feel like a group hug? Because it was such a process yeah. for everybody.
Did you have a group hug?
We didn't. I think we patted a few people on the back just uh-huh, uh-huh. because in the end, the people we're meeting in the community now, they're like, hey, how you doing? Mm-hmm. Like, you're processing mm-hmm. still mm-hmm. because so much. And maybe it was the nature of the case, but I think in general, you go places that you wouldn't normally go with a group of, right. for some of us, strangers.
Right. All right.
Yeah, it didn't feel like we really got closure. And that's something that I think maybe right. could be part of the system that could make it better that, you know.
Right. Okay, you're free to go.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's have a little debriefing there, you know. But we can right. do that on our own okay. time, too.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much for being with me today and being with the community. Thanks for the work that you did.
And thanks for choosing this topic, Deborah.
Yeah, thanks. So it's very, very interesting to me. Thanks. All right. Welcome, Devin. Welcome to the show. Now, there's a lot to know about you, I'm sure, even though you're still a young man. You just graduated from high school this year. But your family has been here for a very, very long time. But I don't think you have. You didn't really grow up here. But when did you move in?
I came like freshman year and I stayed till sophomore year. And then right after my sophomore year, I went to Anchorage and I went to Bartlett. Then halfway through the year, I ended up going to Virginia for a while.
The state of Virginia?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
So then I was there, and then at the beginning of my senior year, I was going to Service High School, and then like I transferred to West, and then I just...
You've been to a lot of school.
Yeah.
All right, but you graduated from Haynes High School, right?
Yeah, I decided to come back.
Right, and your grandfather is David Light, yeah?
Yes.
All right. Very good. So, of course, you're kind of known in the community for your athleticism, right? I think so. It comes to you naturally, or do you have to work at it?
It came naturally, but I had to put in the work to get.
And you
to
recently
where I
came
am.
Back from. So, tell me where you are.
I just got back from state, and I was gonna do this all-star thing, but I didn't really qualify, I guess,
mm-hmm.
because it was my time that I made to qualify was at state. So,
oh, I see. Didn't have enough time to get that taken care of. So you're now graduated from high school, and do you have plans? Are you going to carry your status as a athlete elsewhere? Are you going to stay in Haynes? What are your plans?
I keep wondering whether I should go this year, like take a year off. I'm still
take
not
a year
sure.
off from what?
College.
Oh. Like,
kind of tired of school already. So.
Well, you did go to a lot of schools, I think. Yeah. It does sound like that. But so do you think that you could, well, so what are the options that you're thinking about? Besides not going to school or going to school?
Going to a community college or a
mm-hmm.
JUCO.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to decide what I want to do, or I can go to a Division II college, but I'd rather go to a JUCO. So.
Uh-huh. At JUCO?
Junior college.
Oh, okay. Okay. And what might you be interested in studying, or would you go for sports?
I want to be a physical therapist.
Excellent. I want to encourage that. I wouldn't wait. I know, this is not Deborah's advice column, but I would say you're young and you're healthy. I'd say go be that physical therapist as soon as you can be. All right. Well, I think that's I've taken up some of your time talking today, but thank you very much. 5 minutes is up, Devin. Thank you very much, and good luck to you.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks for coming by. And that's it for Talk Around Town this week. Thanks for checking in with the Community Matters, and thanks to Tom Morfitt, Jessica Edwards, Heidi Robichaux, Glenda Gilbert, Steve Vick, and Devin Light. Special thanks to Margaret Friedenauer, the KHNS News Director, co-host, production engineer, and all-around support. Join me next week for an episodic first, an expanded Hey, Who Are You?, where I'll interview former Representative William Thomas about his life, his legacy, his dreams, his failures, his loves, all of that. And in the meantime, care for your guests. You're listening to station KHNS 102.3 FM, Haines, Clequan, and Skagway.